Play it from the top, I'm staying. Let me get a track just to make sure I'm...
What's up, y'all? Welcome back to the Lunchtime Fluidity Podcast. It's your boy Raheem Doe. I'm back on the mic, and today I am joined by a very special guest. This is my Uncle Terry, so go ahead and say what's up.
What's up? How y'all doing?
Shoot, so we gonna hop right into this. What area did you grow up in?
I grew up in the Crescent City, which is New Orleans, Louisiana. They call it a crescent because the way it's shaped. It's shaped like a crescent. Pretty laid back, what they call the Big Easy, because it's such a laid back, you know, city. A lot of good eating and a lot of entertainment, entertainers, and have a lot of fun sometimes. We got a lot of festivals in our area. And, you know, if you're into that music and stuff like that, you can have a good time.
And when were you born?
I was born in 1949. So I'm one of the seniors in my family, you could say. I grew up in a family that was pretty close. Like my siblings before me said that we had a big, large family. You know, we had like 11 kids in the family. And I was my mother's oldest son. So I was like the one that everybody had to look up to. And I was like, my daddy used to always tell me, okay, well, if something happened, I'm going to blame you. So I was kind of like, have to make sure that everything went pretty smooth, kept people in line, per se.
Mm.
I went to school through elementary up until junior high. Then I left after graduating. I went into the service.
Being that you were born in 1949.
All right.
That means you grew up through the 50s to the 60s.
That's exactly right.
And so?
I grew up to some changing times, yeah.
Being through that time period, what was the experience like as a Black male?
Well, I could tell you this. In my younger age, I grew up in a mixed neighborhood when I was young. And the neighbors next door to us, they were white. I never had an issue. I didn't even know anything about racism and anything, even though it was there. We knew it was there. My father and them talked about it, and we knew it was there. But I never had really got involved or saw it happening to me until I got older, which I mean older, it's like about, say, junior high school. When I really started seeing how people want to be different or think that they're better than you or something to that nature. I remember I was doing a summer vocational studies, and they had me working at this utility plant. And so I took one of my brothers to see, because he said, man, where are you working at? And so I said, I'll show you where you're working at. So I drove him over to the area, and I was just showing him around the building.
Mm-hmm.
The police drove up, pulled me over, said that, what am I doing in this area, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, didn't want me even driving around the neighborhood. I'm like, all I'm doing is just showing where my where I work at. It's just showing my brother where I work at. He was like, well, you need to get off these streets. Just like that. And I'm like, what?
When was this?
I said, here, I got, this was the police.
No, when?
This was in the 70s.
In the 70s?
Yeah, this was in the 70s. I mean, but it's, you know, incidents like that. You know, periodically you just have these encounters with police. It's just one of these things that we have to deal with in our society, especially in the area that we grew up in. I remember I was in this restaurant, and I know it was sort of racist, but at that time that was the only area that was close for us to get a meal or a sandwich, and so you had to still go around to the back. At that time.
Oh, so you experienced like segregated bathrooms, water fountains, stuff like that?
Oh, man. When I was 8 years old, 9 years old, they still had the screens, what they call these screens they used to put up, which said color only. And it would be like on the streetcars, and they would put them on certain areas of the streetcar.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to be behind that screen. I have experienced that. I've had experience when my grandmother and I, my grandmother used to take care of me very much during I was coming up. And so I used to always take off on the weekends and go with her because she lived in La Place, a little area about 40 miles away from New Orleans. So we caught the bus. So this particular time, we was on the bus and the bus was real crowded. And my grandmother had gotten a seat. So on the way, these buses stopped at this particular place and picked up a few people. One of the individuals was a white lady, young woman. My grandmother exactly was older than this lady. She had to get up out of her seat. Now, I was about 9. And I told my mom, my grandmother, I call her mom, but I told my grandmother, I said, why you have to get up? And she just told me to be quiet. Mm. You know, just to be quiet. You know, go back and sit down, be quiet. But she had to get up and let this woman sit. I have literally saw that during the time I was, you know, when I was coming up at a young age.
Your grandmama, her name is Mama Velma, right?
Yes, yes, Velma Lee Van.
My dad told me to ask you, did she ever speak about our ancestral background and them experiencing slavery?
I'm going to tell you, when I grew up, my family, the older people, they told us kids are to be seen, but not heard.
Kids?
So, younger kids need to be seen, but not heard. What they mean by that, when adults are speaking or talking, you're not supposed to get into adults' conversations, okay? You're just supposed to be there and just, you know, be observant, but just be there. So we could never ask these questions about, you know, certain things. Now, if they would speak about it, then we would sit and listen and pay attention. But most of the time, they wouldn't even talk about those things. So those are some things that, you know, you really didn't get to hear until later on in life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but she hardly ever talked about, you know, like her experiences during times of slavery at those days. She would never mention those things. Now, you talk about my grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
Now, her husband, he always was an entrepreneur. His name was Victor LeBan. When he was in New Orleans, he owned what would we call a sweet shop, which was like a neighborhood grocery where you could pick up, you know, just the bare necessities like rice and beans and maybe some cold cut stuff like that. But he had that in a neighborhood where, and during those times where Black folks wasn't doing this.
Mm-hmm.
When he left and he got his stuff established in La Place, he wound up building a place and he had a barroom. And he had a barroom up until he passed away, you know, where he served, you know, liquor and stuff of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, back then, they still had a little mafia going on. And my grandfather even had what they call one-armed bandits in that place where, you know, they used to go and certain people used to go back there and gamble off the these machines, you know. But, you know, back then, music boxes and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
these mafia people had, you had to pay them a certain amount of money to keep those things in your establishment.
This is a mafia within New Orleans?
Oh, yes. Big time. Carlos Marcellus was still around. And that was one of the biggest mafia guys in New Orleans, all the way down to Florida.
What was his name?
Carlos Marcellus.
Well, I remember you mentioned how Mama Velma doesn't really speak about her experience with slavery.
Right.
And I mean, like, this is just why I'm trying to record things and get stories from, you know, my ancestors, because I feel like it's important down the line where we could listen to this stuff. Like,
because history means something. But the thing about, like I said, when I was young, the elderly people didn't talk about, even though we knew that there were issues out there, they wouldn't try to let us see it or feel it. Because like we were like poor people. I mean, but we never knew that we were poor.
That's what my grandma said.
We always had things available to us. Like I never went, you know, thought about not having a meal. Matter of fact, like I said, my grandfather had this little neighborhood store. I used to go in there and get in trouble because I used to take like these big whole sausages out and go cut it up and give it to the neighbors next door because I know we had more than they had.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to do that. I used to take things like cheese, bread, and you give it to the next door neighbor. And my grandfather used to say, boy, what are you doing? You know, and I was like, well, they were hungry, you know? And then he would chastise me, don't do that no more or something like that. But I never felt as though we were actually poor, even though we were.
Yeah. That's exactly what my grandma said. There was no clue that y'all did have less then, but it was just more of y'all were just living together. You know, y'all were
right.
It's just existing.
It just exactly. It was just that we and my mother always found some sort of way to do things to keep us happy. Like whenever Christmas came along, all we ever got was skates.
Skates.
Got a pair of skates. The girls got dolls, and we got skates, the boys. And then once our skates got to the point where the straps or something like that broke off them, then we used to take and make what they call skateboards. We used to take and make these little skateboards, and then we have skateboard for a while. But that's just what we did back then. We didn't think about it as though, you know, we were, didn't have anything. Or we were, you know, wasn't privileged to have all these riches as walking around with all these video games and stuff that the kids have these days. Wasn't nothing like that. I mean, we used to just play jumping rope, play jacks, create games, hopscotch. That's the sort of stuff that we did when we was kids. You know, they didn't have too many playgrounds back then. And then certain areas you couldn't even go in. So, your parents would say, well, you can't go over there. They wouldn't say why, but you couldn't go over there.
Can't go.
Right. Now, they had certain areas, like when you went out by the lake, they had certain areas where we could go to get into the lake. But all the nice areas was for certain people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just how it was. And we knew that, you know, so we dealt with what we was, you know, what was put in front of us. Yeah. And that's just how it was. Yeah.
You also mentioned that you were in the military, right?
Yeah, I was a Marine. I went to Vietnam. I served 3.5 years.
You want to talk about your experience in Vietnam?
I was trying to be a very, very, very good Marine when I first went in. My attitude was going over there, serving my term, serving my country, and returning home. But what happens is, at that particular time, we were fighting for our rights, all right?
Yeah, as black men?
Yeah, black men. Yeah. They would do things to us, certain things, you know, like if you try to build, you know, wear a fro and stuff like that, they would make you cut your hair and all that kind of stuff. So it makes you become belligerent, you know? And so when you get out of boot camp, you figured you have accomplished something, but then they still try to belittle you, put you down. I remember one time I was over in Vietnam and we were having what they call the muster. You know, we were getting ready to, you know, have roll call. And this particular Lance Corporal, because I was a Lance Corporal at the time, but they hadn't given me my paperwork. It was still in the office. But anyhow, he walked up to me and he said, hey, boy.
Oh.
And when he said that, I told him, I said, there's no boys in Vietnam, you know, and I was ready to fight. And they knew. And my partner, mine was out of Chicago. He said, Terry, don't hit him, you know. And I'm like, man, he called me a boy. He said, who do you think he is? And it's like that, you know. But they tried to make me seem they wanted me to become insubordinate. So
yeah.
I backed off him, you know. And I mean, but those are the kind of things that happens over there. I used to walk around with effing on my shirt in Vietnam. It got to that point. I didn't care anymore.
So you didn't.
Whatever went down, went down.
When you say you didn't care, was it more
because
of...
what I mean by that is that okay, I had became very seasoned. What I mean by that, I knew my way around, ins and outs over there. I knew how to handle a bush. Matter of fact, they called me. I had came to the rear because I had a medical issue. And so I was in sick bay. They came and told me, Terry, we need you back out in the field. We need the experience. We need you back out in the field. I served 11 months in the bush. You hear me? Yeah. You see, that's because they wanted to see black men out there putting their lives on the line. You hear me?
Yeah.
And I had enough experience that I wind up getting stripes and stuff, and they didn't even know I had stripes because everything, you know, all the paperwork was coming in, but I was still out in the field. When I came back to the rear, then they say, Terry, you know you're a sergeant now. I'm like, what? I'm walking around with still Lance Corporals on my side, you know? I didn't know. But when I went to Marine Corps, it was still really a gung-ho type of Marine, you could say. You know, you had to be very hardcore, you know? And it got to the point where, you know, all you knew was to fight.
So you were on the battlefield.
Oh, yeah. I walked the DMZ, buddy.
Oh, in Korea?
I walked Ho Chi Minh Trail, put it to you like that.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, it was very hostile. It was a hot, hot area. Mm. You know, yeah, you could easily get killed. Yeah, we've seen all kind of crazy things. People had heads cut off and all kind of crazy stuff, you know. But that was all part of war.
Would you say, is there a regret? Any regret going to war?
No, I don't. You see, because I volunteered, so I don't look at it as being a regret. I look at it as, you know, when you run across people, people are going to try to inflict their views and their points or whatever across to you. Either you agree with them or you don't. Some things you agree with people and some things you don't. I just have certain issues with certain people. I remember my gunny sergeant, when I was going through boot camp, he told me that you wouldn't make it in Vietnam, you know? And that was one thing I had to prove to him, that I could make it. I could make it anywhere, you know, if I put my mind to it, you know? And I think he got shot 2 or 3 times. I never did. I came back injured free.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know, this might be a personal question, but I just want to understand the nuances of it. But is PTSD real thing when it comes to
a lot of folks, right? A lot of folks. You know, I don't know. I guess because I had all kind of encounters when I was young. I always had issues. My mom had to come pick me up from school because somebody always had tried to pick a fight with me because I was a loner. I always was by myself. So I had to defend for myself. So when I went to Vietnam, I was always a loner. So it was always a way for me to survive because I always had to survive when I was a young kid. So I never had, you know, I never worried about being up over there or things, because things blew up all the time, you know, in my life. So having guns shooting around, look, man, I remember an incident. We was on this reconnaissance. And we had came across this village. So they don't know we out there, okay?
Mm.
So we walking around and here come a PT boat. We could hear the boat. When I tell you, they opened up a 50 on us.
50
and this cow. Was our, yeah, this was our own people. So we had to hit the ground. I hit the ground laying flat. I could see traces going across my body. And I had to say, friendlies, friendlies, friendlies on the radio. Because at that time I was carrying the radio. And I'm howling, friendlies, friendlies, friendlies. Yep. Sure enough. But, you know, certain people can deal with certain kind of situations like that. I had a friend of mine. He had an incident that happened in Vietnam. He was in the army, and they had a booby trap, and a mine blew up. And he seen people literally was on fire. And I'm telling you, every night when he got back home, he used to run through the house hollering, screaming. His wife used to tell me that he woke up running through the house hollering and screaming. I'm an industrial electrician, retired. He was also. One early morning, because we had to get to this place for 6 o'clock in the morning. So 5 o'clock in the morning, we're driving. And it was very misty that morning. And he was kind of like nodding out. He woke up and hollered and screamed, "Man, you saw that tiger jump across the..." All that. No, he said, yeah, he said tiger. "You saw that tiger jump across the car?" And we looked at him like, "What you talking about?" He was reflecting back to Vietnam at that particular time. Because obviously he must have ran and had an encounter with some sort of animal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure enough. But some people have those issues. Yeah. Luckily I did not.
I probably got two more questions about the topic. So thinking back to your first time in the field.
Yeah.
What was your thought process?
Well, at first it was like, what am I got myself into?
Yeah, that's what I'm imagining. Like,
yeah, you know? that was the first thing that came across my mind. And actually, when I was in boot camp, my thought process was that this is like Boy Scouts, because I was a Boy Scout, you know, and I felt as though it was like getting started until it started getting real, real serious, you know, when they started doing other little serious training. But in the beginning, I looked at it as an outing. That was my view in the beginning. But you're gonna have all kinds of different emotions. It depends on what's in front of you at that time, you know? Yeah.
So it wasn't, no, you didn't freeze up?
No, I never froze up. You know, even when we went through the gas chamber and they did take off your mask and stuff, you know, I just, okay. What we got to do, let's do that. You know,
I'm not talking about training. I'm talking about in the field.
Well, in the field.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna tell you, we had to go through Guam, not Guam, Okinawa. We went to from Hawaii to Okinawa, and then we hit Vietnam. When we hit Vietnam, the first thing happened was that it was so hot over there. It's like you being in the oven. All right, but when I hit the name, bruh.
The name?
They put the name, yeah.
Mm-mm.
When I hit the name, and then we went to the site, the hill that we was going to be on, we had incoming that day we hit. And I didn't know where the bunkers were. So I'm freaking out. I'm like, where do I run to, you know? And then all I did was follow everybody else.
Yeah.
And so when I saw somebody jumping in the hole, I jumped in the hole behind him, you know? But yeah.
Yep. So it got real.
It got real intense at that. And then you realize, man, this is for real.
Mm.
Yeah.
So last
I remember I was on this operation called Antenna Valley. We was on this tall, tall mountain, 665 feet in the air. And we were coming in, and so the Viet Cong's had a perimeter set up, and we trying to land, and we couldn't land, so we had to jump out the helicopter. So we jumped out the helicopter, and then when we got down on the ground, we set up our own perimeter, and we started walking. I tell you, within a half an hour, you heard a 60 went off. We started pulling the guy back. His legs were cut off.
Dang.
Yeah. And that was that. That's when I was like, okay, this is on. We're ready for action.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. But but the Marine Corps, they drilled it into that you have to be ready for anything. So I was ready for combat, you know. I really was, you know.
Yeah.
My mindset was that, you know, pay attention. Watch what's going on around you and watch where you step at and be aware of everything that's in front of you.
I mean, you obviously you did it right because you came home with no injuries, no nothing.
Well, yeah, I was fortunate because a lot of folks didn't, man.
Yeah, so
a lot of my friends didn't make it.
But last question about Vietnam. Did it change your outlook on America?
I realized that it was a useless war.
That's what I mean. You know, like, did it affect it who you were prior to leaving America?
It changed me. Because I was a little young, innocent kid at that time. I was looking for, you know, to be a good Marine and to do well, you know, that kind of thing. But it hardens you, it makes you become, you know, your personality changes a little bit if you let it, you know, because I had to kind of remember that when I go back to America, that I can't have the same, you know, views that I had when I was in Vietnam, like quick second, you know, these quick second thoughts about doing something, you know, you had to kind of like set that back in the back burner now and don't react on everything. Because when you're out there, you have to respond to everything right away, you know, and you have to make a quick decision to shoot somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But when, you know, so I had to kind of like put those things on a back burner. And that's the hard thing, you know, trying to do once you come back home.
Yeah, assimilate back to the environment.
Yeah, trying to flip that switch. Yeah, because, well, you're never going to be the same. It's just that you hope that, you know, you don't inflict any kind of negativity on somebody, you know, because of, you know, your experiences. Because, you know, you could become quick-tempered after a period of time of being in a war.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
So, I mean, when you got back from war, you got married after?
I got married after I came back home, right.
So how did you meet your wife?
Matter of fact, she was working for one of my a cousin of mine's, first cousin. And she's no longer here anyhow. But that's another story. But anyhow, she was walking down the street and it was a beautiful black girl. And I just ran over to her. And because she was new in the neighborhood, I had never seen her before.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, you know, what's your name? So she told me her name. She said, Lois. And I'm like, girl, you're a beautiful woman, you know? And I said, could I take you out one time, you know? And she said, well, I don't know, you know, like that. And so I was like, well, you know, but what you doing around here? I never seen you before. So she said, well, I'm working over here. And it was my cousin's house. So I said, oh, okay. I said, you know those hunters? She said, well, like, yeah. So I was like, okay. I said, who you know? I said, you know Clyde and them? So she was saying, yeah, I know Clyde and Keith. So I said, okay, cool. So man, look, the next day, I was right there waiting. And when she came, you know, I was like, hey, how you been? You know, she was like, boy, what you doing here? I said, I'm just coming to see you. And next thing you know, boom. She invited me by her mother house, and I went by the mother house that night. And after that, we just developed into a relationship. And at that time, I was getting ready to go overseas. I was getting ready to go to boot camp, actually. And so she waited for me. And when I returned back from Vietnam, we got back together and we wound up getting married. Had two kids, you know. She wound up passing away.
I'm sorry. But I mean, yeah. I just feel like that's beautiful though. Like,
oh yeah, it was.
You know, for her to stay around and with the possibility, because yeah, you came back from war, but like that's a situation where you never know what will happen.
Right. You know, because she was, matter of fact, when I came home, it was her senior year. And so I wound up meeting her at school, you know, and you know, I ran her down, and she was at school, you know, and I was trying to figure out if she was still like me or not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, you know, the fire was still there somewhat, and we got that kennel to start brewing again. And next thing you know, we wind up getting married.
That's good.
Yeah.
So, how did Hurricane Katrina affect you?
Well, during Hurricane Katrina, it was just a lot of water and stuff like that. But, you know, we were used to hurricanes, not as severe as that one was, but we were used to hurricanes. So, you know, to us, it was just like a lot of water. Let's go out there and play. Mm. So, you know, yeah.
That's vastly different from a lot of people.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's just about the way it was. Our parents was used to dealing with that situation, you know. So now they did a lot of damage in certain areas, because the school wind up having us volunteer to go and clean up certain areas, like, you know, the courthouse, certain schools in the area and stuff like that. So, you know, I was part of, you know, of cleaning up behind that storm. Yeah. But it didn't really affect me that much.
Would you say that you are just a very laid back and chill person? Because
pretty much.
I say that because two historical events that many people would deem as very stressful situations, you're just like, you know, it's whatever. You know, where do you gain that mindset? Something.
I don't know. But, you know, in Vietnam, you know what they used to call me? Bruh, be cool. That's how they say, bruh, be cool. That's what we're going to name you, bruh, be cool. Because, you know, everything that came up, I just was, you know, like, okay, bro, let's just deal with it. You know, whatever comes up, let's go with it, bro.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, you know, whatever it is, that's just deal with what's in front of you at the time. And they call me bruh, be cool after that.
I mean, I can see it. The name fits for sure.
but I always was reserved and quiet. I was more of a observer. I watch what people do. I watch people and see exactly what kind of personality they have, and see if I could pick up on their personality. So I was always quiet and laid back. You know, I studied people, at least tried to.
Mm. Do you have any grandkids?
Yeah, I got 8 grandkids now.
The real question is, if you could tell your unborn great-grandchildren anything, any lessons, what would you provide? What knowledge would you drop?
Well, this is what I would tell some of my grandkids, or most of them, is that life is easy. Life is really simple. You know, certain things you just do in life because you got rules and regulations. People make it hard. Some people put barriers in front of you, and you have to know how to cross those barriers and jump over. Sometimes you see that hole that they try to put you in. You got to know how to go around that hole, you know, and move forward. And so this is what I would tell my grandkids. Just keep moving forward. Don't let nobody hold you back. As long as you stay positive, great things can happen. And God never creates nothing that evil. People make it evil. People make it hard.
You said just life? People make life hard?
Right. People make life hard. Life is simple.
Yeah.
People make things difficult. People put certain things in front of you. People put certain rules. And then people change rules. You know. And then rules are not set up for everybody. Laws are not set up for everybody. So, you know, you just have to understand certain things and understand that this is how things going to wind up putting a barrier in front of you. You just have to understand how to get around that barrier because it's going to be there.
And if you had to put your life into a soundtrack, what 4 to 5 songs would represent?
I don't know, bro. I don't know. I think, I know one of them is, you know, try to be happy, you know. So So that's one. Do it my way.
Do it my way?
Yeah.
By who?
My way would be. That's Frank Sinatra.
Frank Sinatra, I've never heard.
No?
No, I'm too young for that.
I got you, bro. Da, 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 na, na, da, 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 na, na, da,
I heard
da,
that melody. Da, na, na, da.
Okay, well, that's the song. Let me see. In a nutshell, I'm just easy. Easy like Sunday morning.
Mm.
Lionel Richie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I heard that.
Yeah. My wife and myself, Stand By Me.
Stand By Me. That's perfect.
Yeah.
For my last question for the day for you, Aunt, when was the first time you've left New Orleans?
I left New Orleans, well, other than 18, I think it was, well, I went to other little places, but not out of the country per se, up until when I joined the service. And then when I came back home, I started traveling because I became International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, so I can go work just about anywhere in the country or the world. So I started traveling. You know, I did the Olympics in Atlanta. I worked in nuclear powerhouses. So, you know.
You worked at nuclear powerhouses?
Oh, yeah. I worked in nuclear powerhouses.
There was radiation and stuff around?
Yeah.
So did you have to wear like special suits?
The whole suit, baby. The whole nine yards. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You got to be trained. Oh, yes. Very much so. Yeah. I got to know about the rays and so forth. Yep. Big time.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I did that. Yeah. It's an experience. Put it to you like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got your clean areas and your hot areas and your hot spots. Oh, yeah. Been down there. Look, bro. I done had to go into silos and inside these places where you had to go in there with stuff, you had to leave it. You couldn't bring it back out because it was so contaminated. So I went in with tools, but I left the tools.
So you had to come in with, you have to come with new stuff every day?
Yeah, you have to. What they would do, they would give you certain tools that you can only work in that area with. But they were hot tools after that. So they have to go into what they call a radiation area that they kept those tools in those particular areas. Now, all my outfits and suits that I had to put on, which was like a spaceship outfit, we have to discard them in parts as you get into one clean area. Then you would take off certain parts and then you would move it to another area. Then you take off the rest of the parts until you get clean. And then after that, you know, you have to go through a radiation counter and the checks if you got any rams or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. But all right, y'all. That was Lunchtime Foodie Podcast. I had a great time talking and chopping it up with my uncle right here.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate it.
Really picked his brain. This was the ancestral plane segment of the podcast. Hope everybody enjoyed. That's the Lunchtime Foolery Podcast, y'all. Peace.
Peace with you, man.